Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Good evening and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, and Greg Priddy is at Secret Training Camp, so he's not really here. I'm winging it tonight. I want to begin the show by thanking you for all your generous pledges for Radiothon 2013. The Outspoken Cyclist proudly sits near the top of the fundraising efforts. We did a fabulous job raising over $2,500. I am pleased. I am humbled. Numerous shows on WJCU have been on the air for many years, longer than we have, and it's a testament to the generosity and interest of the cycling community that propelled us to such a high place in the standings. Give yourself a pat on the back. I'll give myself a pat on the back. On-air thank yous will begin next week. I do not have the list in front of me. It's going to be sent over to me. If you ordered a premium with your pledge, it will be shipped out the week of March 11th, I'm told. And by the way, very few people asked for a premium. Almost everybody said, nope, give all the money to the radio station. You guys are just awesome. I just loves you so much. Thank you so much. You may remember that this show is being pre-recorded because right now I'm really in Denver at the 2013 North American Handmade Bicycle Show. It was reported earlier this week that all of the exhibitor booths are sold out. Hotel rooms are booked all over downtown Denver. I'm sure Don Walker's walking around with a big smile on his face because a sold-out show is a good show. So before I left for Colorado, I wanted to talk with someone with whom I'll actually be working on Saturday night, tonight, and it's going to be something you can listen to if you like. Josh Simons, better known as Too Tall from Velocipede Salon, and I will be emceeing a session called Smoked Out Live. It will begin at 7:30 p.m. Mountain Time and run to 8:30. We'll be having a sort of round table discussion with some of the rock stars of frame building and invite you to listen in. But I wanted to talk to Josh before we left so I know what I'm doing when I get out there. Plus, he's always fun to talk to. Our second guest this evening is Brett Horton. Brett and his wife, Shelley, own and curate one of, if not the largest, collections of bicycle racing memorabilia in the world. The collection started with Brett's desire to keep cycling's history alive, and today there are thousands of items, including jerseys, trophies, programs, and any of a number of unusual and priceless items, all in his museum, I guess, in San Francisco. A few years ago, while I was at NABS in San Jose, Brett was offering a limited edition of his book, Cycling's Golden Age. It details the collection and, in turn, racing's history from 1946 to 1969. The book's foreword is by the legendary Eddie Merckx, and in it he says, quote, I am so happy to see that Shelley and Brett Horton have taken it upon themselves to preserve the tangible history of the sport. Nearly every photograph in this book is new to my eyes, yet they all bring back so many memories of my childhood and young adult years. To see how Shelley and Brett's collection has grown over the years is wonderful. I am pleased that they have taken such care of these special items. I know that the memorabilia they have from my career will be well looked after. So we'll talk with Brett about his collection and some of his favorite stories. He's got some great stories, and how cycling and collecting have become such a passion in the life of the Horton family. I'll review some of the news items from this past week, and there are a couple of doozies. So kick back and settle in, and let's talk with Josh Simons. Hi, Josh. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. We're both heading out to Denver on Friday to attend NABS, and you've cooked up a pretty interesting party. And you even asked me to help. I wanted to talk to you so that I know what I'm doing when I get out there. Talk about the event. What's behind it?
Well, first, Dan, thanks. I'm really honored that you had me on the show. It was just lovely to be back again and hear your charming voice.
Used to it.
Yeah, I know. So, Diane, you know, I got to point out that I'm a hack. you know, at this radio stuff, and you risk lowering the bar by freely associating with a known guy like me, you know. What are you thinking, huh?
Hey, you asked me. What was I going to say? No, you can't turn Richard Sachs down. Or you.
Desperate, you know.
Yeah, I got it.
So this is this party is sponsored officially by NABS, the best I can tell, Paul Skillback and Don, certainly Don has been participating on our forum for quite some time, and their readers, and I think they caught on to the fact that something special was going on at Velocipede Salon, and that this might play well to a live audience at NABS. And the short story is they called me up and asked. I think the sponsors are all interested in hearing something from the people who are also standing behind the tables and are exhibitors. And doing this in front of an audience of, you know, VIPs who are in the industry, mostly not customers, should be very interesting. It's sort of executive networking, if you will. Non-motivational. Anything could happen.
And I'll bet it will. So who is actually, now I know, but let's let our listeners know who the different players are on the panel side. Who are we going to be asking questions of and them getting answers from?
Sure. Gary Smith, IF. Nick Crumpton, Crumpton Bicycles. Eric Eastland, Winter Bicycles. Dave Wages. And Tim O'Donnell, Shamrock.
Wow, what a great group of people. I noticed there aren't any women, but then I'm the token girl, I guess, huh?
Chano, if y'all would just step up the game and start building more frames.
I know. I know. So how many people are this is in the ballroom. How many people are you expecting at the frame builder party?
Well, he's given me some rough dimensions. Paul's booked a large room. There's food, there's booze, there's live music, and I don't know the exact numbers, but if you suss out the clues, he said that everyone with an exhibitor's pass or a VIP pass is going to get in.
Got it.
I would multiply that by one plus a small entourage, and there you go.
Let's talk a second about the VIPs. Do you know some of the players on that side?
Skull and Bones, Diane, Skull and Bones.
Well, like, are people coming from Shimano or people coming from some of the other sponsors?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
You kidding?
Yeah.
They want to know who their players are. They get a direct line, and no schmoozing behind tables. We're going to talk.
No, and I know the questions, and they are interesting, and I think we're gonna find out some things about frame builders. So, for those who don't understand or know what it is, explain smoked out. And then how smoked out is going to apply to this event.
Okay, that's nothing to do with Chi Chi Chong.
No, I didn't think so. Then again, we are talking the bike industry, but go ahead.
Yeah, this is true. Velocipede Salon, the world famous salon, is the host for Smoked Out. And Smoked Out is a portion of our web forum where frame builders and industry tell their stories in first person. We invite them to at first speak, tell their stories, speak about themselves, whatever they want, with pictures and stories and notes and graphics, and to explain themselves. I think of it them as, in a way, as artists plus. The plus part is, yeah, you got to make a living too. But no artist worth their salt does not somehow create and form what they are before they offer what they're doing to the public and charge money for it. And I think they do the same thing. Everyone wants to know what the backstory is so that they can relate to it. And then once they've gotten that out and it's sat for a while and people can read it, we open up the web forum so that people can comment. It's closed up until that point. And once the comments start, we encourage the builders and industry folks to interact freely with people who are commenting, and relationships begin to form. And these people are sometimes potential clients. Sometimes they're networking with them on a more of an industry level, and some of these conversations have gone on for years and have tens of thousands of views. So we know it works, and I think NABS is going to get a three-dimensional version of this.
It's a great idea, a great idea. So we have an hour to talk when we're out there. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably going to run over because we're also going to take questions from the peanut gallery. But we've formulated a specific question for each builder and then ones that we're throwing out to the general panel. Do you hope that something's actually going to come out of this that actually might change anything or that might enlighten? Do you have any expectations of it?
Great question. No.
Okay.
I don't. It's really something that should happen and is lacking.
Okay, that's good enough. So we're calling it Smoked Out Live. So it'll be audio only, or is there going to be video?
It's my understanding that there's going to be a live video feed that will include the possibility for folks from the interweb asking questions live while we're speaking. It's kind of a weird happenstance. I got a call from someone who is friends with Alchemy, George Thomas, who is a real luminary in the world of ultra-distance cycling.
Yeah, he's the Ram guy.
Yeah,
he's Mr. Ram.
Yeah, and you know, I supported Cassie Lowe as the massage therapist and nutritionist twice for Race Across America, and you know, the Transcontinentals, and I've done all sorts of ultra racing over the years, and his name popped up, and he calls me on the phone. He said, "Oh yeah, I'm George Thomas." And I said, "Hold the starship, George Thomas." Yeah, George Bleepin' Thomas. So it was very nice to hear from him. Apparently, he's this is his business now.
So he'll be there.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. You're saying on the interwebs. Will there be a link on Velocipede Salon? Is that where it's going to show up? Or
George is responsible for providing that. He hasn't just yet. We're waiting for it.
Okay.
I know it's a difficult thing to do, but the place to watch for it will be Velocipede Salon.
Well, and I imagine, you know, we can use Twitter and we can use whatever else we need to. I think it's going to be awesome. I'm very excited. So do you think the discussion will get serious or do you think it's just going to get silly?
I don't know. It depends if these guys are sober.
Good point. It's free booze. I forgot. There is that.
Yeah, it can be serious, but I hope it's not. It's a frank discussion in front of an audience of peers. And when things are, you know, open, transparent, and free-flowing, no need to get serious. There won't be any politics. If there is, I'll stop it.
Sure. Sure. Well, I'm really excited to be part of it, and I'm really excited to hook up with you guys again. You know, just the frame builders are just such an interesting group of people.
Are they not?
They are indeed. What I'll do is probably when George sends the link, I'll send it up to the Outspoken Cyclist Facebook page. Because I already have people who, you know, I mentioned it on Facebook this week and people are like, whoa, when can I, where can I, you know, I'm going to tune in Saturday night. So they can listen to the show and then tune right into the live feed. That would be very cool.
Terrific.
All right. Have a safe trip out.
Thank you, Diane.
I'll see you in a few hours.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye. Josh Simons is in New Hampshire getting ready to come out to NABS and meeting me out there so we can do this Velocipede Salon Smoked Out Live. And you'll be listening to this about the time that we're getting ready to do this live feed. We're going to move right along, and I've got lots of news this week. Here we go. You might remember last week I reported on the Virginia state legislators taking up the anti-doring bill. Well, many may have suspected it, but according to Tom Jackman, who writes the blog Nova, Northern Virginia, for the Washington Post, Fairfax's Senator Doering cyclist safety bill fails on a tied committee vote. 7 delegates are no-shows. So people didn't even show up. It will continue to be acceptable in Virginia, legally if not morally, to open your car door into the path of a bicyclist after an anti-Doering bill by Fairfax Senator Chap Peterson, Democrat, passed the Virginia Senate and then a House Transportation Subcommittee. The House Transportation Committee voted 7-7 Tuesday on the question of reporting it to the full House, and a tie is good as a loss in the Virginia General Assembly. So Virginia will remain one of only 10 states in the U.S. that do not prohibit Doering. Cycling has become an increasingly popular way of getting around Northern Virginia, and providing for rider safety on our congested roads would not seem to be controversial. Cyclists also sought the law so that insurance companies could not reject their medical claims by saying that no fault had been assessed by police after a bike versus car door accident. But 7 members of the Transportation Committee didn't show up for the vote, including 4 from Northern Virginia: Tom Rust, Republican from Herndon; Tim Hugo, Republican from Centerville; Barbara Comstock, Republican from McLean; and Rich Anderson, Republican from Woodbridge. Just one vote from any of them would have sent the bill toward passage. The problem for all 4 of them was that they had other committee meetings scheduled at the same time as the Transportation Committee. That's pretty much the end of that for Virginia for now. Peterson, who had guided the bill through the Senate and part of the House, said this is a safety issue, and 40 states, even Alaska, have this exact law. Alaska. In Alaska, he says, you're more likely to hit a moose than a bicycle in Alaska. I'm troubled as to why some people don't want this safety law in Virginia. True, you could probably hit a moose more likely than a bicyclist. It's pretty bizarre. So if you're riding in Virginia, stay away from the door zone. The colloquium, you might remember we talked about the I Am Traffic conference. Well, it is taking place this weekend in Orlando, featuring overviews of the best in bicyclist and bicycle-related training programs. The meeting will also lay the groundwork for the creation for a new national bicyclist organization that will work to improve conditions for bicyclists through complementary strategies of education, engineering, enforcement, encouragement, evaluation, and most of all, equality. By the way, the conference is sold out. So Mike Wilson and Carrie Caffrey will report back. Actually, it's going to be Carrie Caffrey and John Schubert who are going to be reporting back on what happens at the conference this week. Something about no more taxes rings a bell with me, but Washington State has some other ideas for their transportation needs. Reported by Daniel Snyder from Outside Online on Thursday, February 21st, Washington lawmakers propose bike tax, part of a $10 billion transportation package. Here's what Daniel wrote. Light your torches and start angrily brandishing your bike locks. They're coming for you. Washington State Democrats rolled out a new $10 billion transportation package Wednesday that could raise taxes on gas, cars, and even bicycles. According to the Seattle Times, the package would place a $25 sales fee on bikes worth $500 or more, a move projected to raise $1 million over 10 years. The state gas tax would also increase by 10 cents over 5 years, and cars would be taxed 0.7% of their value. Democrats will attempt to pass the package in the legislature or, barring that, submit it as a proposal to voters. The plan puts $10 billion to work and is investing in the future of the state, says House Transportation Chairwoman Judy Clyburn. It will fund the projects that fight gridlock, improve safety, and definitely promote economic development. I don't ever remember that kind of a package passing. We try in the bicycle industry to get $1 a bike for promotion and advertising. That never worked. So getting $25 a bike, I don't know how that's going to happen. Who knows? And by the way, what's the chance of $25 or $1 million in 10 years going to bicycle-related projects anyway? Who knows? We'll just have to see. This is about the FBI. Mm-hmm. They have been asked to aid in the probe of the Iron Horse breach. Dozens of event registrants' credit cards were used. So Shane Benjamin wrote this for the Herald staff in Colorado. Durango Police Department has requested the FBI's help to investigate widespread credit card fraud that targeted numerous people registered for this year's Iron Horse Bicycle Classic. Meanwhile, race officials worked Friday to identify the source of the security breach, said Gage Sippy, director of the event. "We are still trying to understand where all of this took place," he said. "As of right now, there is no clear path. Dozens of credit cards have been used for fraudulent charges, all with a common thread of also having been used to register for the Iron Horse events." Organizers are unsure how widespread the problem is and whether all the credit cards used to register were compromised. Most of the fraudulent activity appears to have occurred during the first week of February, but some people have reported fraudulent charges up to 3 weeks ago. Sippy said fraudulent charges have ranged from $200 to $1,400. The charges have occurred at a variety of vendors, including Match.com, GameStop, Groupon, Micro Center, Lowe's, and the U.S. Postal Service. Some people said their credit card companies automatically denied suspicious charges and shut down the card. Organizers are unaware of any security breaches involving the Iron Horse website, which does not store credit card information. The Iron Horse uses third-party companies, including Durango-based Mercury and Plug and Play, to handle credit card processing, he said. People who suspect their debit or credit card has been compromised should first contact their bank or credit card company, then contact the Durango Police Department. That's pretty nasty. This is ugly, too. Round the World UK Cyclist Killed in Thailand. This is by Gregory Katz from the Associated Press on February 18th out of London. A British couple's Round the World cycling odyssey ended in tragedy when both of them were killed in a road accident in Thailand. Peter Root and Mary Thompson, who had been chronicling their journey in a blog, died Wednesday when they were hit by a pickup truck in a province east of Bangkok, Thai police said Monday. The couple, both 34 and from Guernsey in the Channel Islands, left Britain in July 2011 and had cycled through Europe, the Middle East, Central Asia, and China. The trip was a once-in-a-lifetime experience for the couple, who met in art school and spent 6 years saving money and planning their journey, Peter's father, Jerry Root, told the Associated Press in an interview. "They were both inspirational," Jerry Root said. "They didn't just talk about it, they did it. I couldn't be prouder of them." He said they were both experienced cyclists who knew the rigors and risks of extended bicycle travel. They were camping wild, as they called it. The couple had been posting photos and details of their trip on the website Two on Four Wheels. They also had many followers on Twitter and Facebook who were tracing their journey and vicariously enjoying their adventure, which included a trip through remote parts of Central Asia. A video they posted from that part of the journey shows them camping in the desert, riding through hills, stopping to swim in rivers and lakes, and braving heavy snowstorms. They also cycled through tense situations as armed conflict breaks out during their journey through Tajikistan. Thai Police Lieutenant Colonel Supachai Luangsucharan said Monday that investigators found their bodies, their bicycles, and their belongings scattered along a roadside, along with a pickup truck that crashed between some trees. Supachai said the truck driver, 25-year-old Warapong Sanghawat, was seriously injured in the crash. He told police his truck hit the cyclist as he was reaching down to pick up a cap from the vehicle's floor. Supachai said the driver had been released on bail and faces charges of causing death by dangerous driving, which carries a maximum of 10 years in jail. And then this was a really upsetting video. It's just unbelievable. If you want to, go to Google and type in horn rage and Boulder, and you're going to be able to see this. A Boulder judge rejects plea deal for Erie man accused of harassing cyclists because the victims must be notified first. This is by Pierrette Shields, Longmont Times call, and posted by the Daily Camera from Boulder, Colorado on the 15th. A 75-year-old Erie man accused of harassing two cyclists along County Line Road in September by following them and relentlessly honking his SUV's horn tried to take a plea deal on Thursday, but a Boulder County judge rejected the plea until the victims in the case could have a say. James Ernst negotiated a deal with Boulder County prosecutors to plead guilty to 2 counts of harassment and 2 counts of improper use of a horn. But Boulder County Judge Noel Bloom said he would not accept the deal. Two cyclists recorded a video of Ernst driving his SUV behind them on County Line Road in September while honking his horn. The men put the video on the internet and it garnered thousands of views and comments. The incident highlighted the ongoing tension between some motorists and some cyclists in Boulder County's roads. Boulder County Sheriff Joe Pelley said that the issue is among the top issues among county residents. Colorado State Patrol investigated the video, tracked the SUV to Ernst, and ticketed him in 2 cases. He's charged with 2 misdemeanor counts of harassing, 2 counts of illegal use of a horn, and 2 counts of driving too slowly. Ernst had not obtained an attorney to represent him and told prosecutors on Thursday that he just wanted to conclude the case. He told Blum the same. "This has put a lot of stress on me, sir," he said. Blum reset the case for February 21st and said he does not foresee any issues with concluding the case at that time once the victims are notified of the pending plea agreement. Outside the courtroom on Thursday, Ernst, who has declined to offer his side of the story to reporters, said the media has gotten it all wrong. He said he honked his horn to 2 cyclists who were rude to him and pounded on his SUV. "I'm riding on the road that is too narrow for bicycles. No shoulder, double line for miles," he said. He declined to answer specific questions and instead waved at a video camera, taping his comments, and walked away. Well, let me tell you, if you go watch this video, there is no question that he was harassing the cyclists, in my opinion. And because they had the video, you know, they could get him in court. And obviously they did. He was wrong. He was just dead wrong, as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, last but not least, Bruce Gordon, who, you know, I always think of him as a curmudgeon. And I don't see him as a very tech-savvy guy, but he posted his favorite blog to Facebook this week. So knowing that Bruce is sort of kind of curmudgeonly, I decided I'd take a peek at what piqued his interest. And lo and behold, he did discover a gem. The site is called Applog, P-L-O-G, because it's more of a photo blog than a writer's blog. It's called Pedaling Nowhere. It's a lovely series of entries about, well, here's what it says. Basically, we are 3 people who simultaneously came to terms with the fact that adventure, the day-to-day time, cash, and you only live once. We decided to make some big changes, take a bicycle journey from Mexico City south. The initial intention was to create a photo-driven blog to document the trip, but we'll probably write about bikes, food, art, people, or whatever our tires roll across. We're leaving on December 3rd, which they did to start the tour. Check back often. It's got a lot of great photos. Each of the 3 write when he or she feels like it. One of my favorite posts was Pedaling Turns Nowhere, 1,000 miles. They listed a whole bunch of what they called useless statistics. It's fun. It's interesting. Pretty pictures. So if you're looking for something to do in the winter and want to see something, there's not a lot of writing. It's just kind of a fun plug, as they call it, Pedaling Nowhere. And that's all the news I have. We're going to go to a break. And then when we come back, we're going to talk with Brett Horton of the Horton Collection. And I think you're going to really enjoy hearing some of his stories about some of the greats in cycling. We'll be right back on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
I'm in the car next to you on the highway. I sit in front of you on the bus. I'm 1 out of every 6 Americans, and I'm struggling with hunger. This isn't an uncontrollable epidemic. There's enough food in this country to feed every hungry person. Please, visit feedingamerica.org today and find your local food bank. Every dollar you donate helps provide 7 meals for those around you, quietly struggling with hunger. Together, we're Feeding America.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
We're back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, and we are ready to talk with Brett Horton, who is the curator and owner of the Horton Collection. He's in San Francisco. Brett, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Well, good evening, Diane.
I'm pretty excited to talk to you. We have met. We met at a NABS in San Jose, the second San Jose NABS, when your book came out. And we'll talk about your book in a little bit. But you and your wife, Shelley, are the curators of the Horton Collection, which has to be one of, if not the most extensive collections of bicycle memorabilia in the world. So can we begin by talking about how and when you began your collection?
Well, I actually began the collection when I was racing, and that would take us back to late 70s, early 80s, and where it really, at that point, I would really characterize it more as an accumulation than a focused collection. And it was predominantly generated by trading my jerseys for other riders as I traveled around the country racing. I had, at that point, was riding for Specialized, and they had quite a bit of clothing that they had given me. So that's where the genesis of this collecting cycling memorabilia actually started.
I know that the collection is basically bicycle racing. So you've really narrowed it to a specific niche. How did you choose just bicycle racing?
Well, as I'm sure you can appreciate, the concept of bicycles is an incredibly wide spectrum.
True,
you
can
be talking about, you know, are we going back to high wheel bikes? Are we talking, you know, touring, commuting? There's so many aspects that really make up the landscape and fabric of cycling. And for me, as I began to focus and really pursue the concept of my interpretation and my point within the cycling spectrum, was really focused on racing, and that was really driven out of personal interest. And even within that spectrum, it's not the complete bandwidth of competitive cycling. What I really focus on is from the late 1800s, when we moved to safety bicycles, where we have bicycles that have two wheels the same size, is really where my interest kicks in, up through today. And it's men's elite road racing and track racing. So that's going to, and the track racing has a stronger focus on 6-day riding. And that is the kind of the world that my wife and I have really focused our attention on.
Well, something that didn't occur to me until you just said track racing and 6-day, is there anything in your collection that sort of details some of the problems that 6-day encountered with fires around the country? Do you know anything about that? I've always been curious about that.
Well, I have a personal crossover, but not with the American scene. It actually ties back to the Ghent Velodrome. My wife and I are fortunate that we go virtually every year to that 6-day, because that for us is pretty much the soul of the 6-day. You know, for us, that Ghent represents that, and there's been 6 days that have come and gone. Ghent had a fire a number of years ago, and they actually, in repairing the velodrome, they never replaced the bell. And as I'm sure you're aware, on a velodrome, you have the bell lap.
Right.
And you have a physical bell, and they ring it on the last lap, and off we go. And they just had this annoying electronic buzzer. And a number of years ago, I'm thinking that was 2006. Early that year, I had talked to Patrick Surcoux, a friend of mine, who he is the race organizer at Ghent, and had just proposed the idea that Shelley and I give Ghent a lap bell, and which he was very happy to receive. And we had the bell made here in the U.S. It was actually made in New York and had it custom made, that has it debossed with the logo of the Ghent 6, and it has Patrick's name on it. And this was originally intended more as a gift for Patrick, and it took on a life of its own. And voila, we have a bell that they haul out every year for the 6-day, and you know, I'm quite proud that it's, you know, the association it's made, because it's given the U.S. Another little footprint, and I actually got the high holy honor the year that it was brought out, that I was actually invited to ring the bell to start the 6-day, and you know, which it again was just a thrill for us to be able to do that. And it all ties back to a fire at the velodrome.
To get back to the original question, which is really interesting. I actually read about that story and think it's just amazing. So one of the really interesting stories that sort of began part of your collection, you know, was something you call stalking Eddie Merckx. And I know you've traveled far and wide. You know, we're outing you as a stalker. But explain that story, or tell us that story about how it became a reality, because he actually wrote the foreword for the book and it was so gracious about it. And, you know, I've met Eddie Merckx. He's a big guy, and, you know, but I don't think of him as being sweet like that.
He's a sweetheart. He's a big teddy bear.
Yeah.
I don't think I would have ever wanted to race against him, and I can understand why he elicited so much fear, but he is just a prince of a guy. It started for me when I really started to have interest in building a true collection. You know, I was able to acquire a couple of vintage posters, and, you know, it's more decorative, and I really didn't have the resources to play ball in any depth until the mid 1990s, and then when my wife and I really kind of sat down and we're talking about it, the analogy came to me of collecting pennies. And if you think back, and little kids collect pennies and they have these folders and they put all the pennies in the different holes, they're always missing whatever, the two or three pennies that are actually worth more than 1 cent.
Right.
And I use that to look and go, well, if we're going to build a cycling collection and we want to have something that's, you know, has some significance, forget all the other pennies. Let's start. We got to have the three pennies, those are the ones we really need to focus on first. And to me, if I, you know, there's plenty of riders that if I had a jersey, a bike, whatever from that rider, it's cool, it's neat. But at the end of the day, if you don't have Eddie Merckx, you know, it's good, but it's not going to be the wow, wow, wow factor. So hence we started the Stalking Eddie program. And at that point, I knew that Eddie went to Interbike almost every year and actually went down to Interbike, met with him, you know, when he was just in the booth. I had some old posters, which kind of intrigued him, that there were stuff that you didn't really see so much in the U.S., and it was very nice to autograph it, and there wasn't really anyone else hovering to have a piece of time with Eddie, so I was asking him point blank about, is it possible that, you know, I might be able to acquire, you know, a jersey, but I'd take anything, a dirty sock, didn't really matter. So he said, oh, you know, well, if you're in Belgium, give me a call and, you know, we can get together. Now, I'm sure in his mind that was, the last time I see this guy.
Right, exactly. So was, only they didn't know about, you.
Yeah, so it was about 2 months later, I'm in Europe, call him up, and, yeah, true to his word, I think he was a little surprised, but true to his word, okay, come on up. And that really is what started it. We were, met with him and was able to get just some phenomenal pieces from him. I ended up getting a jersey from every team that he rode for, and a yellow jersey, a World's jersey, and a Maglia Rosa as well. So it was a happy day.
I guess. Let me take a moment. We are speaking with Brett Horton, who is the owner and curator, he and his wife Shelley, of the Horton Collection out in San Francisco on the Outspoken Cyclist. So you have your Eddie Merckx, which filled in some of your pennies. And I know you've spent a lot of time over the years with riders, dining with them, all kinds of stuff. Why are they so willing to give you or sell you or however you obtain their prized, precious possessions for your collection?
Well, I think if I'm doing an aggregate, you know, a composite of it, I think it really falls into, you know, probably three categories. One, and I think the most important one really is, call it the caretaker, the credible collector, whatever, that when I meet these guys, and by the way, it's much easier now because we've been doing it now for close to 20 years.
Sure.
But early on, I would meet the riders and, you know, make the pitch. And one of my favorite stories is when I met Eric Zobel for the first time. And this is when he was winning his green jerseys, and it was first year, I think, 95 or 96, whenever it was that he had won his first green jersey. I was at the Worlds that year, a couple of months after the tour, and he was in the bar with Rolf Altag and a few of the other guys on the German team. And you know, I just said, okay, I'm just going to go give him a try. And I went up, and one thing I've never done is I never ask for anything free. And I offer money, and I offer what I view as very real, you know, motivating money. Not stupid money, but just that I'm not trying to buy a jersey for $10.
Right.
And I went up to Eric, knowing that he knew how to speak, you know, some level of English. And I know that, you know, I want to be sensitive of their time, and I just asked him, you know, hey, I'd really like to, you know, one of your jerseys that you wore at the tour this year, one of your green jerseys, and I will pay you X. And I to this day, hysterical comeback, he looks at me and goes, oh, God, I love Americans.
What he really meant was, I love American money.
There you go.
That's awesome.
And that's really, you know, it. And then where it had evolved in time is as I was getting kind of deeper and deeper into the well and, you know, starting to have a better contact base with older riders and then, you know, meeting newer riders. And I would interact with them and they would try to flesh me out because, you know, trying to figure out what my game was, what angle, because at that point you didn't see a lot of Americans at a number of these races. They would ask, well, what do you have in your collection? And I'd start rattling off a few things. And they're clearly in their eyes, it was BS, BS, BS. So then I had spent some time in to hire a designer that made a little folio that I could take around. And I'm thinking this is rolling us up now into 1997, 98, that then when I would go up and meet a rider and they'd ask that, I could actually show them photos that, yes, I do have Anca Thiel's yellow jersey and the first Paris-Roubaix medal and the original stopwatch for the Tour de France. And then that changed the landscape. They realized I wasn't just a guy who's going to turn around and flick it and sell it on eBay. And that really helped that equation. So I think it's that, again, that credibility that I'm not just there to take something from the guy and sell it. And then I think, you know, the other two factors really are money. You know, some guys have different needs and wants, and you know that especially for the contemporary rider, you know, it is for the most part just another jersey. It's not a huge prized possession, but the money to me, what that does is it's a nod of respect on my part to the rider. They didn't get that jersey free.
Right.
They've sacrificed years to get to that point, and for me to then walk up and stick my hand out and say, give it to me free, it smacks, you know, just of bad form. And then there is the final thing, which is, as an American over in Europe, particularly during when we first started collecting, we're really a novelty act. They, you know, there are plenty of people that just found it borderline comical that here are two Americans that actually have a reasonable depth of knowledge of racing and European racing history. That was something that I found that the European riders, both active and retired, frankly responded very well to. And I can say I've never been turned down when I've asked to go meet someone at their house, particularly the older riders. Everybody has always said yes and been very nice about it.
Wow. So were there any promises that you had to make before somebody would give you something, you know, anything that, you know, you obviously agreed to and have, of course you would keep your word, I am sure.
Well, there's occasionally, depending on the circumstances, you know, it which really varies from rider to rider. There's some riders that I find that in approaching these guys and talking to them, it's really understanding what's important to them. And they can put a condition on of, don't sell this item. And
okay,
if I'm buying one or two things from a rider, to me that's an easy promise to keep because I have no intention. There are situations where a rider wishes to dispose of everything they have. And then I'll have a little discussion with them about, okay, I love you. Yes, I can pay for all this, but I really don't need 40 of your jerseys for myself. Are you okay with me trading, selling, whatever, the ones that I don't want? And invariably, it's okay, you know, with them, but I don't want them to find out through the grapevine that I bought 40 of their jerseys and I've now sold 10 of them, 20 of them, whatever the number is.
Sure.
Then, you know, there are those who are concerned, you know, if particularly if they are a well-known writer and they don't have a lot of stuff, they want to know that I am willing to loan the stuff for exhibitions, which are predominantly in Europe, given that racing is a European sport at its core. And to that, you know, which is, again, never a problem. And then the third one that I would say is pretty common is if they've been to my website, if they've seen any of the stuff exhibited, they know that we have some pretty nice photographs. We have studio shots taken of virtually everything, that they would like a nice studio quality photo just so they can have the, you know, a little memory of the item. So that's generally about the three things that there is conditions that tends to be the majority of them.
So once again, I'm going to remind you that we're speaking with Brett Horton. He and his wife Shelley have this just humongous collection of cycling memorabilia. And I want to talk about your book. I happen to be one of the lucky ones. Well, I should say Brian, because my partner has the book. It was a gift to him from me, actually, of the era of 1946 to 1967. And it's a beautifully bound book in a beautiful sort of box that opens. Tell me about that era and why it's such an important era for cycling and why you decided to highlight that in that book.
Well, it was really, part of that was driven by the publisher, Velo Press, and thanks for commenting how much you liked the book. I think Velo Press did a just awesome job. Of the different publishers that I had talked to beforehand, I felt like they were the ones who really got the concept and ran with it and had good layout, good paper, on and on. So I'm still pretty happy with how that turned out. When we looked at that time period specific to what the years that are featured in the book, the notion was we wanted to hearken rather than a contemporary, you know, book, that we wanted to have a historical bent and feature a time period that a lot of people romanticize, and also one that people are going to know some of the names, be it Louis-Saint Bobet or Jacques Anquetil or Hugo Coblet. There's a number of writers that there would be some resonance and recognition of that person's name, and also it tied in that with the writers that we also had a good spread of photographs and jerseys and trophies and bicycles, the things that tie to that. So that was basically the focus, and then the concept was that we were, from that, assuming that there was success with the book, then we would have other editions that would follow through on that. And I know that Velo Press is keen to have more books, and it's me getting up the motivation to put the time in that it requires to do a book again. And I tell people that when I get asked that quite a bit about when is the next book coming out in that series, I relate that it's asking me that's akin to asking a wife who's just delivered a baby that when can we have more kids?
Right, exactly.
And I think I must be kind of getting over it, because there is another book that kind of is in the conceptual phase right now that I think I'm going to chew off on that will come out either later this year or next year.
How many items? Let's talk about the collection itself. How many items are in your permanent collection? Because you have a permanent collection, and then you do, as you said, have things that you can and will sell on your website.
Well, yes, and the permanent, and this is where I always start feeling like, okay, where am I on that line between a hoarder and a collector?
You know? Yeah, the cat lady, right, I got it.
Yeah, you know, and I question, am I the cat lady? And, you know, because when I start particularly looking at certain aspects of the collection, you know, that, you know, specifically, the collection, the bulk of the material is race-worn jerseys with provenance. For me, a jersey that I go buy in a bike shop that's of a pro team, that doesn't really count for me. It's the that jersey has no soul. It
right.
only counts to me if the guy actually wrote it, and I got it from his off his sweaty back at a race, or in the case of an older jersey that I'm getting it directly from the writer or the writer's family, somewhere where the provenance is tight. And we have approximately, at this point, about 3,000 jerseys, and we're trying to actively decrease that down to probably ballpark of about 500 jerseys.
Wow, that's a huge change.
Yes, but what we're really doing is saying for books, exhibitions, whatever, rarely do you ever need more than 50 or 60 items for that are framed out the side of the jersey for an exhibition.
True.
And I would really rather winnow it down and say the jerseys that we have are rock star jerseys, that they are all home runs, and having 500 home runs, I don't, you know, that's
yeah, how bad could it be?
Yeah. Then it's the bicycles, and that's one, that's probably the one facet where people are most intrigued about how few bicycles we have. We've kind of imposed a 25 bike limit, and it's because bicycles take up a lot of space, for one, and then second of all, with the bicycles, because we've put on a limit, before I'm going to go out and buy another bike, I've got to figure out which one is going away. So it has caused me to be an extremely picky buyer on what I want. I want a, you know, I want the bike that has a really good story to it, whether it's a personal connection I have with the rider or the rider's very significant in the landscape of cycling. It's really got to be special. We also then have posters, and the posters, like everything else in the collection, they go from about 1892 up through today, and the modern ones, and by modern I'll define that as largely post-war, but particularly from 1970 on or so, because you cease to see stone lithograph posters. Those are easier to come by because it's much more contemporary and there's larger print runs. The romantic posters or the stone lithograph posters that you saw predominant was pre-World War II, and those are items that can be affordable to very, very expensive and everything in between. And we've got ballpark of about 1,600 posters. And then on the photographs, same time period, the only photos that we have in our collection are either the glass plate negatives, the 35-millimeter negatives, or original first, the very first generation prints that were made of them. And that totals out to about 350,000 photos.
Wow.
And then the library, and the library was built similar to the photographs, that we're really using the photographs not to be photography collectors, but to be able to document the provenance on the jerseys. And the same thing with the library. You know, it's even now, there's not a lot of depth and breadth on the nuances of a lot of these races. So we've expended a lot of energy to get all the contemporary publications from the time period going back into the 1800s to see how was this race reported at that day versus something that's written now about a race in the 1890s. The person writing it, for all I know, has used, you know, reports of reports of reports, and we're
sure.
Five generations from the source. And it also, for us, is really fun when we can find photographs printed in a magazine from 1897, and we have the glass plates at our house. Is pretty cool. So that's kind of the focus of our collection as far as the breakout between the different categories. And there's probably there's about another I think approximately 8,000-9,000 items that don't fall into those categories, be it ceramics, trophies, you know, it can be really
sure.
goofy little things that just fall out of that nice, easy to find pocket.
I only have a couple more questions. We're actually running out of time. I knew we were going to have a fun time doing this. Do you have your sights set on anything that you haven't been able to find yet? I mean, is there any specific item or items that you want?
Well, certainly the focus, the area that always intrigues me the most is the stuff pre-World War II,
okay.
And that's posters, jerseys, but it's also so far and few between to find any of this stuff. But if I say a specific item, it's Eddie Merckx's Our Record jersey.
And I'll bet you know where it is.
I know exactly where that thing's sitting. But, you know, talking Eddie into parting with that one, you know, is an entirely different matter.
Why is it so special? I mean, he's done so many amazing things. But that one, what is it about that particular jersey? Do you know? Or has he told you?
Yeah, actually, I've had the discussion, and I ask virtually every writer of what's the most important. First of all, the most important for almost across, I'd say across the board, is it's the memory. But I'll ask them, is it the trophy, the race leader's jersey, you know, the race jersey, or the bike? And interesting enough, it's vast majority of time, it's the jersey. Because the writers will say, and Eddie, you know, was probably the most eloquent about it, saying, the jersey is my best memory. You know, I wore this. I want to ask, well, what about the bike? You know, you're riding the bike. I see that a lot of times as a kind of a tool of, I don't think he used the word pain, but that doesn't have the embodiment of fun for him. And then he looks at the trophy and says, that's a souvenir.
Interesting. Well, we're fresh out of time, and I know we could go on and on with a bazillion more stories, but I think it would be of interest to our listeners to find out how they can see at least the website, if we can say it's HortonCollection.com.
Sure.
And then my last little question, which we only have a moment to talk about, is where do you actually have exhibitions? Do you have any?
Yes. Well, generally, there's the public exhibitions in the U.S. The ones of recent have been at the U.S. Cycling Hall of Fame in Davis, California. And then, a large driver in the purpose of the website is so that people can see a lot more of the collection than they would at any physical exhibition to begin with. And, you know, that's generally what drives it. Folks can also arrange to, have a visit to our collection to see it physically. And then in addition to the HortonCollection.com, we've also launched a Facebook page that you can find it by just the Horton Collection, and that's where we're putting up a lot of these newer items. We just started that a few weeks ago, but people who particularly like some of that old stuff, it's a lot of images that, you know, you're simply not going to see anywhere else.
Well, Brett, I really appreciate you taking time to talk with me about the collection and about your stories about the collection.
Certainly.
Okay. All righty. Good night.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. So that was Brett Horton. He is the curator and owner, as we said, of the Horton Collection. I will say the book that we have that we talked about is magnificent. I went through it again before this interview with Brett. Also, we're on our way out to NABS. A whole bunch of us are going out to NABS. So I hope you'll come back next week and join us on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm out of here for now. Have a great week. If you can get some miles in, do that. Ride for me. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.